We are talking about the Table of Nations in the 10th chapter of Genesis and a portion of the 11th chapter of Genesis. And never did really define exactly what we mean by the Table of Nations. Maybe it's self-evident to a lot of you, and maybe it's not all that clear to everyone. But what is a table of anything? We're not talking about the kind of table that you set your cup of coffee on when you have breakfast in the morning. But we've had things like mathematical tables that we learned in school. It's an ordered list, right? That kind of a collection of information. And that's what we're talking about here is a collection of information. It's information about the families that originated the nations of the earth. It's an ordered list of the families that were the background for all of the nations of the earth. And the song we just sang about the whole wide world being in the hands of God, that's really a part of the point of this section of Scripture, is the fact that God was very much in control, and God had a hand in the way the nations were dispersed. In fact, I want to take a couple of minutes this morning and just look at some symmetry that I find interesting. Before I do that, this thing that we're calling the Table of Nations, which has been traditionally called the Table of Nations, it's been subjected to a lot of scrutiny over a lot of centuries. It's very, very old. We were talking yesterday about it going all the way back to Shem, the son of Noah, and being transmitted down through the family line through Abraham and his seed, his family, and on down to the time of Moses, and then being incorporated into this volume that God wanted to be retained for all of humanity in his word. And that information, being very, very old, you would wonder about how accurate or reliable it is, and it really has stood the scrutiny and the test of time. We have a lot of individuals named in this 10th chapter of Genesis, and we don't know who all of them are in relation to the nations of the world, but we know who quite a few of them are in relation to the nations of the world. The history that is recorded there is accurate, legitimate history. Several years ago, an archaeologist named William F. Albright, who used to be one of the premier archaeologists of Israel, and he was not particularly a believer in the Bible. He did use the Bible in his archaeology and his digging and his explorations, but he was not particularly a believer in the Bible. He was not a Christian. But in looking at the Table of Nations, this is what William F. Albright said about it. He said, "It stands absolutely alone in ancient literature, without a remote parallel even among the Greeks. Where we find the closest approach to a distribution of peoples in geological framework, the Table of Nations remains an astonishingly accurate document." And what he said there some 70 years ago is the truth. It is an astonishing document. Its antiquity is without parallel. Its accuracy is without parallel. We have much later nation lists by other authors that are not nearly so correct, nearly so accurate, or nearly so complete as what we have here in the 10th chapter of Genesis. And it is, as we were talking about yesterday, based on the family of Noah. It is a post-flood document dealing with the new world, the very strange and bleak new world that the sons of Noah came out to find. Now, I'm sure it became a fairly lush world there in the Fertile Crescent in the Mediterranean region fairly quickly with the new plants growing and animals proliferating and so forth, but a wild world, a world that was to be conquered all over again by humankind as they set out in their new beginning. It was not particularly a friendly place. There were lots of carnivorous animals and lots of challenges and lots of difficult terrain to overcome, perhaps more so than in the world of creation, the world that had perished in the flood. It was probably in a number of ways a less friendly world. One of the reasons that I say that is because when we look at the lifespans that are recorded in the 5th chapter of Genesis, we look at men whose lifespans are recorded in the 900, the range of 900 to 1,000 years, 969 being the oldest on record. And when I look at the lifespans that are recorded for men after the flood, I see that that is a diminishing quantity. And we're going to really specifically talk about that a little bit later. But that men are living shorter lives in the years after the flood, and that there is a transition point where they even get shorter still. And that's the Peleg question that we're going to talk about probably more tomorrow. But the world that they faced when they came out of the ark was a bleaker and more difficult world than they had known before the flood had happened. Now, in the 10th chapter of Genesis, we have the account of the three sons of Noah. Rather, we have the account of Shem about the three sons of Noah, and those three sons are Japheth and Ham and Shem. That's not their birth order. Their birth order seems to have been Japheth and Shem and Ham. Ham is the youngest. Japheth seems to have been the oldest, although there's a little bit of uncertainty over exactly how to interpret the passage about Japheth and Shem as to whether it's saying that Japheth is the older and Shem is next. I think that's what it's saying. I think that Shem is the second child and Japheth is the first child. But at any rate, in looking at the descendants that we have listed here, before we actually list those descendants, I'd like you to just take the time to count them all. Count all the descendants that are listed there. Okay, don't take the time to count them all. But if you did take the time to count them all, you would find that Japheth has 14 descendants listed here. Now, this is not anything like an exhaustive list. This list has information that was available probably to Shem during his lifetime, and he lost track of the family as it scattered and as they multiplied and so forth. But if you count the descendants of Japheth that are listed here, there are 14 descendants of Japheth. And, in fact, I'll just make note of that here. Japheth had 14 descendants listed. And then we have, well, let's do it in the order that Shem did it. Then we have the descendants of Ham. And for Ham, we have 30 descendants listed. And then we have Shem. And for Shem, we have 26 descendants listed. And that's a table, okay? And how many is that? 70. Okay. Now, I like that number. And I don't know whether Shem particularly liked that number or not, but I like that number for a variety of reasons. Turn to Genesis chapter 46 and verse 27. Genesis 46, verse 27. This is the account of Jacob's migration to Egypt. And in verse 27, it says, all the sons of Joseph who were born to him in Egypt were two persons. All the persons of the house of Jacob who went to Egypt were, how many? 70. Okay. We're reminded of that over in Deuteronomy chapter 10 and verse 22. Deuteronomy 10, verse 22. Moses is giving his final series of addresses, reminders, warnings to the children of Israel before his death. And in Deuteronomy 10:22, he says, your fathers went down to Egypt with 70 persons, and now the Lord your God has made you as the stars of heaven in multitude. God has made you as the stars of heaven in multitude. What's he reminding us of there with that statement? He's reminding us of the promise given to Abraham, right? That your descendants will be like the stars in the sky and the sands of the seashore. All right. In fact, in that promise to Abraham, in the first record we have of the promise to Abraham in Genesis 12:3, we have God saying to Abraham that all the families of earth would be blessed through him. All the families of earth. Now, he talks about nations in some of the other passages, but there he says all the families of the earth would be blessed through Abraham. So here we have the 70 persons who had become like the stars of heaven in multitude during their time in Egypt. And then I'd like you to go to Deuteronomy 32 and verse 8. Deuteronomy 32 and verse 8. This is, again, Moses sharing a song with the children of Israel that is to help them to remember their responsibility to God. If they err, if they fall away, this song is to be a reminder to them of their responsibility to turn back to God and the fact that God will be there for them if they do turn back to him. Deuteronomy 32, verse 8, when the Most High divided their inheritance to the nations. Well, what's he talking about? He's talking about the table of nations. When the Most High divided their inheritance to the nations, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel. Now, the Septuagint has a different phrase there, but according to the number of the children of Israel, that has perplexed me many a time. What does he mean by talking about setting the boundaries of the nations according to the number of the children of Israel? Well, I like the symmetry of this, and I don't care whether you think it's particularly significant or not, but maybe you'll remember it anyway. I like the symmetry of this because how many descendants of the sons of Noah are listed in the Table of Nations? 70. And how many descendants, sons of Israel, went into Egypt? 70. And they came out like the stars of heaven for multitude. Now, God had in mind a symmetry there because what was Israel to be? Well, it was to be the light to the nations. It was to be the torch that kept alive the knowledge of God among the nations until eventually God would bring the Savior, not the Savior of Israel, but the Savior of all mankind. Paul alludes to this idea, or at least I think he's alluding to this idea, in the 17th chapter of Acts, when he was at the Areopagus talking to the Greek philosophers. In Acts chapter 17, verses 26 and 27, he makes reference to the various nations established not by human will, but rather by the will of God. He has made from one blood, Acts 17:26, he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on the face of the earth and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwelling so that they should seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. Now, Paul says God had a purpose in the way he divided the nations, in the way that he caused the scattering and in the places that the various ones settled, that God had purpose in that. And we can see a lot of things that look pretty random and uncontrolled to our perspective in the scattering and in the way nations rose up and so forth. But Paul says really God had a hand in all this. God knew what he was doing. And Moses seems to have said that also there in the 32nd chapter of Deuteronomy, that God set that up in a patterned way, in a way that he had in mind. And it had some correspondence to the idea of the descendants of Israel, the sons of Israel. And God was looking at this future impact that was going to be had when the light of the nations shone among the lands of the Gentiles there in Galilee, when the light of the nations came into the world. That God had that in mind at the time when the scattering of those nations took place, that there was a pattern involved in all that. And I at least like the symmetry of the fact that there were 70 descendants of Shem, Ham, and Japheth and 70 descendants of Jacob, and that those things are drawn together by Moses and are alluded to by Paul and are all a part of God's overall plan of history, of what he was intending to do all along from the very beginning. I want to hand something out, and I don't have enough for everyone to have a copy because I didn't know we were going to have this many people here. It's a reflection of poor anticipation on my part. But I have 120 copies here, and there's probably more than 120 people in the audience. So if you can share with a husband or a wife or something like that, it's good. This is not high-tech or highly critical. It's just a point that I want to illustrate that if you can visualize it by looking at it, then it will probably be a little bit helpful. Could I have a couple people to take some of these and pass them out? Divide them among yourselves, as they say. And what they're passing out is not from the 10th chapter, it's from the 11th chapter of Genesis, but it's a point that I want to make before we even start into the list of names that we have here. In the 11th chapter of Genesis, we have the story of the Tower of Babel, which we're going to talk about a little bit, and then we have the family line of Shem in the 10th verse and following, the second half of the 10th verse and following. We have the descendants of Shem listed for us there. And it's a longer list, of course, than it is. It goes through more generations than the other families that we have, the families of Japheth or the family of Ham. And the reason, of course, that it goes through the longer list, more generations, is that we are looking at the family that's going to be carrying this information, that's going to be responsible for conveying this information to the nations throughout history. We have in Genesis chapter 11 and verse 10, this is the account of Shem. Shem was 100 years old. He begot Arphaxad 2 years after the flood. So how old was Shem when the flood came? Or how old was Shem when he got off the boat? He was 98 when he got off the boat. Okay. He had a son, Arpaxad, 2 years after the flood. So he was 98 when he got off the boat. So he was 97 when he got on the boat. And Japheth was probably 100 when the flood came. Because it says Noah was 500 years old when he begot his sons, when he started having those sons. But at any rate, Shem was 100 years old and begot Arpaxad 2 years after the flood. After he begot Arpaxad, Shem lived 500 years and begot sons and daughters. Now, how long did Noah live? If you have one of these that you can see, the number's right there handy, but you can just turn back a chapter and see it at the end of chapter 9, if not. How long did Noah live? 950 years. But Shem lived how long? 600 years. So that's a very significant difference, isn't it? That Shem lived 350 years less than his father. There's no suggestion that Shem met an early demise because of something catastrophic. Maybe he did. Maybe he would have lived longer than this if he hadn't had some untimely demise. But then again, maybe the simple fact that he lived in a different world, he was already 98 years old when he went into it. But maybe the world, the less friendly world that he came out of when he came out of the ark, had a real impact on his lifespan. Or maybe there were other factors in there that we don't particularly know about. But he lived 600 years. And if his siblings lived a similar lifespan, if Japheth and Ham lived a similar lifespan, then they stood apart from their children too, didn't they? Because Shem had a son named Arpaxad, and how long did he live? 438 years. And he had a son named Selah, and how long did he live? 433 years. And he had a son named Eber, who is the father of what people? Hebrew. The Hebrew people, okay. All the children of Eber, apparently the origin of the word Hebrew, the best explanation of that that I've ever seen anyway. And Hebrews does not just refer to people of Jewish extraction, although it is specifically used that way later in the scriptures, but refers to all those who are the descendants of Eber, and they were apparently an important people because they're singled out in the account in the 10th chapter that Eber was the father of these people. And then Eber had a son named Peleg, and how long did Peleg live? 239 years. Now, what I want you to notice is how those bars go there, because it's a rough depiction of the lifespans of these fellows. How many generations of his family did Shem live to see? Yeah, he lived to see 9 generations. In fact, maybe more, because there may have been, you know, generationally, sometimes some families have children in their 20s and some have children when they're a little older and so forth. But he lived to see some 9 generations of his family in looking at this chart. And my dad is my dad's an old man. He's 92, and he has lived to see his children, his grandchildren, his great-grandchildren, and his great-grandchildren. He has lived children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, yeah. He has lived to see, you know, 4 generations of his own offspring. But Shem lived to see, you know, 9 generations of his own offspring. If we just look at the layout here, and he must have seen these children come, and not only come, but also go, right? Because he outlived a lot of his own children, probably, maybe all of his own children. He outlived a lot of his grandchildren, maybe all of his grandchildren. He outlived some of his great-grandchildren, maybe not all of them. He outlived a lot of his great-great-grandchildren, because what happened with Peleg there? There's a verse that specifically mentions, in his days the earth was divided, and that's why he's given this name Peleg, that means divide, and we'll talk about it a little more. But something happened at about the time when Peleg was born. Something catastrophic happened, maybe the Tower of Babel, probably the Tower of Babel. But whatever it was that happened when at that time, Peleg was named because of it, and it had a big impact, because from Peleg on, they're not living 400 plus years, they're living 200 years, and in fact, generation by generation, it's actually getting a little shorter. Nahor died a little young, but Terah died younger than Serug, and Abram died younger than Terah, and Isaac died younger than Abram, and Jacob died younger than Isaac. And Jacob said at one point in his life, when he's talking to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh says, well, how old are you? And Jacob tells him his age, and he says, well, you know, compared to my father's, my life hasn't been very long, but I'm old and tired. He did not live the kind of life, the lengthy life that his ancestors had lived. But just think momentarily about what kind of an impact this would have. How many of you personally know your grandparents? Okay? How many of you personally know or knew your great-grandparents? Okay? How many of you personally know or knew your great-great-grandparents? Okay? I don't see any hands. Now, my children had the opportunity to know their great-grandmother, but not great-great. But then I was young in relation to other members of my family, and my grandmother did know some of her great-greats, but they didn't know her because they were little. They were really little when she died, and they didn't know her. But here's a situation where for nine generations, you've got this guy Shem, and for one, two, three, four, five, six, seven generations, you've got this guy Arpaxad, and this guy Selah, and this guy Eber, and everybody else is dying, and they just keep on living. Now, what kind of things come out of a situation like that? Because the population is getting bigger and bigger and multiplying over the earth. You know, by the time you get to a family of 100 or so people, you start kind of losing track of the details of the cousins and the relatives and so forth. But as time goes by, you've got these guys who become, well, really kind of legendary figures, don't you suppose? They would be kind of legendary figures because they just keep living on, and the people born after them, they live a long time, but not that long, and the people born after them, they don't live anywhere near that long. So what's going on? And you end up with legends of things like, immortality, for instance, that these must be some very, very special people, some very unique people. And that's why, you know, sometimes the Bible talks about, that makes reference to mighty men of old and some of these sort of legendary things that grew up about some of the biblical characters. And that has some bearing on a few of the things that I want to notice when we look at names of people in the 10th chapter. And I'm going to avoid some of the more speculative things, but some of these individuals who are named in the 10th chapter of Genesis are actually regarded by later generations as what? Gods, okay? Some of the people mentioned in the 10th chapter of Genesis are later regarded by their own descendants as gods, including Japheth himself, and I'm pretty sure of that one. I'm pretty sure that Japheth is an ancestral figure who among the Greeks and the Romans and perhaps the Indians, that is the Indian Indians, not the American Indians, came to be regarded as a deity, as a god. Now, I don't know that Japheth would have particularly pursued that kind of recognition, but there were people in kingdoms that we have historical records of who did pursue that kind of identification, who wanted to be known as divine. The pharaohs of Egypt wanted to be known as divine. The emperors of Rome wanted to be known as divine. They wanted to be seen as gods in the flesh, as having the authority of the gods and not merely the authority of men. And there's probably at least one character in our storyline who really wanted that kind of recognition. And you'll know the name, even though we haven't touched on it all, the name of Nimrod. He's probably one who really wanted that kind of recognition because he was a power-hungry tyrant, and he probably would have cultivated that, whether some of these others would have cultivated it or not. Nevertheless, as we look at this, and the reason I passed out this chart and the reason I wanted to talk about this is because we don't have anything quite like this in our experience. You know, most of us have, many of us have experienced grandparents. Some of us have experienced great-grandparents. Very few of us didn't, in fact, I didn't see any hands in here, have experienced great-great-grandparents. But that idea of being able to look back, and not only look back, but to look back at somebody who is so much older than you, and you know that you will never be as old as they are. You will never live the lifespan that they have lived. That you're going to live, well, 200. We're not going to live 200. We're pushing the envelope tremendously if we live to be 100. But to look at someone who is alive and well in your culture, who has been alive through six or seven generations, and they seem to be doing just fine, and they seem to be still strong and healthy. And what kind of power, what kind of authority, what kind of reputation could they, would they accrue during a lifespan like that? You know, if you made the right kind of business decisions and marshaled your funds and just kept growing your flocks and your possessions, you know, what kind of wealth could you accrue over a lifetime like that? Those individuals, those people who had the 600-year lifespans and the 400-plus-year lifespans, were in a position like that in the culture that came after Peleg, in the culture that came presumably after Babel, but the culture that came after Peleg. They were in a unique position because they had something nobody else had in terms of the years of their life. And there is no doubt that some of them would have exploited that, because human beings are human beings whenever they live. And there is no doubt that others would have exploited that as their children and their offspring and claims of divine inheritance and so forth. Well, let's go to, and we're going to come back to this and talk about some of these things in somewhat more specific detail, but I'm not going to do a lot of speculation about who came to be regarded as a deity. There's a couple that we can identify with some certainty. And one of those is Japheth. Let's go back to the 10th chapter of Genesis. The sons of Japheth were, Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. The sons of Gomer were Ashkenaz, Rephath, and Togarma. The sons of Javan were Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim, and Dodanim. And from these, the coastland peoples of the Gentiles were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language, according to their families, into their nations. And I'm sorry, guys, I should have probably given you both handouts at the same time, but I wasn't sure exactly how. It's like I said the other night, my notes were a jumble, and I wasn't sure exactly how soon I was going to do this. But if you guys would pass out the same way, another 120 copies here for me, I appreciate it. This map is not a highly technical map. It's not a detailed map. It's very rough, but it will assist in illustrating a couple of things that I want to illustrate. Who does it say that the word that's applied right here to the family of Japheth, what's the word that's applied to the family of Japheth? Did you notice that in the fifth verse? Gentiles, okay? What's Gentiles mean? Just nations, okay? But they're sort of specifically, we have the nations of Canaan, we have the Canaanites, but they're sort of regarded in a little bit of a different way than the other nations of the world. And Japheth here is specifically associated with that word Gentiles, with those nations. And just a broad look at what's described here, these are the forebears of what are sometimes referred to as the Indo-European nations, by and large. And the Indo-European nations, by and large, have been thought of as, you know, the whites, the Caucasians, the Aryan people. And that's kind of an interesting idea, especially that word Aryan. That's kind of an interesting idea. It has connotations that were brought out, you know, in the Nazi philosophy of World War II. And I want to talk just a little bit about the idea of race and ethnicity and so forth, and that's one of the reasons why I decided to go ahead and hand out the map right now. The map has, again, very generalized depictions of the scattering of the sons, the offspring of the sons of Noah, and all the ones that have 90-degree angled sides, little rectangles, all of those are these sons of Japheth, sons and grandsons of Japheth. We have Gomer, we have Togarma, we have Ashkenaz, we have Madai, we have Javan, and then there's Javan over there. Okay. Now, if we look over to the left, if you can see this map, or if you've got a map, you may have a map of the nations, the Table of Nations, in the back of your Bible. Some Bibles still have that in there. But if you have a map that you can look at, can you see what Javan is associated with, or maybe you just already know? The Greeks. Okay, that's a good solid identification. Javan is associated with the Greeks. Presumably, or very likely, the Greeks and the Romans share a common heritage there, and there's some good etymological reasons for seeing them as having the same forebear. Over to the right and top on the map, there's another family of Japheth, and that's the family of Ashkenaz. And what name is associated with Ashkenaz there? The Scythians, okay? The Scythians. Ellie, what name is associated with Ash, or what group of people is associated with Ashkenaz in modern terminology? Okay, particularly, yeah, Germany, the region around Germany, the Ashkenazi, the German-speaking Jewish people, and that's because from these Scythian people, from these people that that have Ashkenaz, and you can see the relation between the name Ashkenaz and Scythian, I would hope, just a rough connection there. But some of those people migrated up into the area of Germany and that region of Europe and are the forebears of those Europeans. Over to the right and down, we have some of the descendants of Japheth through Madai. And what nation do we have there? Almost Persians, but specifically Medes. And we connect the Medes and the Persians because they empired together, but they don't have exactly the same lineage, but they kind of come together. Historically, they kind of come together. Now, in thinking of that Medo-Persian Empire, we're thinking of a group that is really associated with Semitic heritage, but it is of the family of Japheth. It is of the family of Japheth. And what modern nation are we looking at when we look at the Medes there, at the family of Madai? It's on the map. Iran, okay? Iran, or a lot of Iranians would like to be known as Persians. They still like that. But the name Iran comes from the same word as the word Aryan, all right? The name Iran comes from the same word as the word Aryan. And if we go over to the east, some of the same people that settled Iran, which are of the descent of Japheth, some of those same people over to the east settled another country called India. And that same term, that same word Aryan that describes the Iranian, also describes the Indian, okay, Aryan. Now, there's a reason that I bring this up right now in a somewhat summary form, and that is that there has been associated with certain things in the book of Genesis, certain kinds of racism over the generations, certain justifications of racism. Have you heard about the mark of Cain? If you haven't heard about it, I don't see any reason to explain it to you now. But is there any bearing? Does the mark of Cain have any bearing on anything in the modern world? No. Biblically, it can't possibly. Why? Well, there was this thing called the flood where only the descendants of Noah, okay, came out of the ark. It can't possibly. Besides which, there's nothing in the story of Cain that would suggest that the mark on Cain was anything genetic that could be passed to anybody else. It was to set him apart for what? For his own protection, right? To set him apart for his own protection. And that applied to him and no one else. There's nothing in the mark of Cain that has anything to do with anything racial or genetic or any kind of a heritage, and it has nothing possible to do with anything after the flood of Noah. So after the flood of Noah, we have another episode, and that's the curse of who? Yeah, except it's not the curse of Ham. It's the curse of Canaan, okay? And we haven't gotten to that yet, but Canaan is one of the sons of Ham, not all of the sons of Ham. And if you look at that and you think in terms of the social custom and so forth and try and rationalize that Ham was being cursed through Canaan, whatever, it's Canaan who is specifically mentioned in that curse. And people have looked at the curse on Ham, which it isn't. It's the curse on Canaan. But people have looked at the curse of Ham and have also drawn racial conclusions from that. Now, are all of the dark-skinned people, because this is what it comes down to, are all of the dark-skinned people on earth of the heritage of Ham? No. Not at all. How about those Aryans of India who are descendants of Japheth? Have you ever seen any dark-skinned Indians, the Indians of India? There are people in India just as dark as the people in Africa. Or, again, we could talk about the Semitic people, we can talk about the descendants of... Who are the dark-skinned people of the earth? It's not the people of Ham, or the people of Japheth, or the people of Shem. It's the people who lived in the hot, arid regions of the earth. That's who the dark-skinned people of the earth are. And where do they come from? Well, they come from the sons of Noah. And how do they end up looking like they look? By living where they live, because God made man so that man could live anywhere on the face of the earth. And if you're going to live in a cold, bitter climate, there are certain characteristics that you're going to need that are going to be valuable to you and your descendants, and those characteristics are going to come to the fore in the process of having children and breeding and selection, the kind of of selection that takes place in human choice and human decision, and as well as natural environment. And if you're going to live in the cold climates of Western Europe of the early days after the flood, you're going to tend to breed lighter-skinned people who are equipped for the cold. And if you're going to live in the hot climates of Northern Africa in those days after the flood, you're going to tend to breed people who are darker-skinned and have other characteristics that are going to be useful in that hot kind of climate. But you're going to have Canaanites who look pretty much like Semites. You know, if you go into Canaan, which is the actual character mentioned in the curse, if you go into Canaan, not into Egypt, which is a different son of Ham, or not into Cush, which is a different son of Ham, but actually into Canaan, you're going to find that the Canaanites and the Israelites look a whole lot alike. They don't look particularly different from each other, because that curse had nothing to do with appearance. And that's all racial characteristics have to do with in our age, is appearance. Because, you know, we build air-conditioned buildings, and we wear hats, and we do all kinds of things to cope with the climate wherever we go. But these residual realities of appearance have nothing to do with value or God's purpose for our lives or anything else. God has reached out to the nations, all the nations, through his chosen nation. You know, the symmetry of the, which again, whether you think that's significant or not, I like that symmetry, between the people of Jacob who went into Egypt to come out a nation and the people here who became the nations of the earth. That God had in mind that the one should bring into existence the atoning Savior for the many, that all should be saved, no matter whether they were of Ham or of Japheth or of Shem, and no matter whether they lived in a region of the world made it more desirable to have darker skin or lighter skin or hair of one kind or another or whatever other features people may have. What we have here in the Table of Nations is the reality that we all share common stock, and not all that long ago, not all that far in the past, we all share common stock. We all come from Noah and his sons and their wives. And it doesn't matter whether we be of Shem, Ham, or Japheth, we all share that common heritage, and we all have the common consequences of sin, not only the original sin of Adam, but of the sins of our forebears, including the incidents recorded right here in the 11th chapter with the Tower of Babel. So let's talk a little bit about Japheth. Japheth had these seven sons, Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. And Japheth himself is, again, as I said, one who is probably remembered as a mythical figure in the languages of several people, but just to mention two. And I don't know that you especially need the spelling of this or anything, but I'm not really going to I-A-P is it T-O-S? No, it's E-T-O-S. That's a Greek name, okay? Iapetos. It's a Greek name. It's a Greek name of a Titan. It's the Titan who is supposed to be the father of Prometheus, who is supposed to be the progenitor of the human race, okay? This name is, in Greek mythology, this is the Titan who is the progenitor of the human race. Now, when I first looked at the correlation between Japheth and Iapetos, you may or may not realize that in the Greek language, the iota becomes the J in the English alphabet. But, you know, you can see a certain similarity of the names. And when I look at people who are biblical believers who draw that connection, I say, yeah, maybe, I don't know. And then I found somebody who was a critic who drew that connection. I said, hey, maybe there's more here than I really thought there was. When someone who is in the school of the documentary hypothesis, and not that's something Wade's going to mention next week, I think, from what he told me, but when someone's in the school of biblical criticism and doesn't really believe the Bible has this ancient origin, and they look at the name Japheth, and they say, where would the name Japheth have come from? And they work it backwards instead of forwards. And they look and say, well, that name Japheth probably came from this Greek god Iapetos. And they work it backward, and they think that some scribe in the 7th century B.C. in Israel borrowed this from the Greeks. Then I say, hey, maybe there is some credibility to this connection. Maybe the connection is actually a legitimate connection, that in the Greek mythology, the remembrance of their ancestral forebear, Japheth, who lived 600 years when other men were living, you know, two-thirds or one-third of that lifespan, maybe they did, in fact, remember his name with this very close adaptation. And it isn't only in Greek that we have that, this Iapetos, but there's a similar name, and I have seen multiple spellings for this, but there is a similar name, and this is in a Hindu dialect, but Iapeti, okay. And this individual is described as being the son of, anybody here speak Indian? Yeah, Satyaurata, Satyaurata, or Satyaurata, or whatever. But there's a story in the Bhagavad Gita, which is supposed to be a pre-Christian document, supposed to be. I don't know for sure when it was written, but it's supposed to have been written somewhere between two to five centuries B.C., somewhere in that time range. The Bhagavad Gita has a flood story in it. Well, you know, practically every culture on earth has flood stories. You really have to scrounge around to find cultures that don't have a story of a universal flood survived by a small remnant of the human race. And some of them are very, very similar to the Bible story. This one is not detailed the way the Bible story is, but this character, Satyaurata, or Satyaurata, whatever, he had three sons, and his oldest son was named Iapetai? Sure, why not? And his next son was named Sharma, and his next son was named Charma, okay, which would be, well, this would be that one, right, and this one would be this one, and this one would be this one, and in the flood story that they have, Charma was cursed by his father, okay. This one was cursed by his father in the flood story that they have in the Bhagavad Gita for laughing at him when he drank too much mead. He drank too much mead, and his son, Charma, laughed at him. And then we have the emphasis on this one as being the forebear of the Aryan people, the Indian people. He was the forebear of the Aryan people. And there is a third place that the name Japheth probably turns up, and this one is maybe not as certain, but I actually have a fair degree of confidence in it, and that's in the Roman name. And who was Jupiter in Roman mythology? The head god. Yeah, he was the chief deity of the Roman pantheon, and he was also known as, Father Jove. That you see the pitter on the end, that's close to the word pater, father. Okay, he was also known as Father Jove, and etymologists have thought, you know, that Jupiter was an adaptation of the name Father Jove. I don't actually think that's exactly the etymology at all. I think that Jupiter is a corruption of the name Japheth, and it happens to be pretty similar sounding to the name Father Jove, but the father of the Roman race and the Greek race, as far as I can tell, was this son of Japheth, Javan. And who was the father of Javan? Well, the father of Javan was Jupiter, or Japheth, rather. And I think that's probably how the name Jupiter worked into the mythology of the Roman people. That those kinds of analyses, this one from the Indian and this one from the Greek both seem pretty solid to me as I look at them. You can find a lot of these, then some of them seem pretty speculative, and I don't want to deliver a whole lot of speculation to you, but nevertheless, and Japheth is by no means the only one. Asher, among the descendants of Shem, Asher is not only the father of the Assyrian people, the chief deity of the Assyrian people was Asher, and we find various connections like that scattered throughout the names that are here in Genesis. And I bring that up because that's part of the reason that someone like William F. Albright, would look at this list and say, you know, there's a lot of solid material in here. There are a lot of real connections that you can see to the ancient pasts of these people, of the people as they scattered over the face of the earth, as they populated the various regions of the Middle East, of Africa, of Asia, and of Europe. So Japheth may very well have been Jupiter. He may very well have been a deity figure among the Greeks. He is known as the father of the Aryan peoples of the land of India and of the land of Iran, as well as the specifics regarding these seven sons of Japheth. And of those seven sons of Jacob, I'm going to ask you if you got one of those maps to hold on to it until tomorrow, and we'll look at what we do know about Gomer and Togarmah and so forth. And in some cases, we're looking at guesswork. In some cases, we're looking at certainty. But for today, we're just about to come into question time, so I'm going to do a little bit of a wrap-up here. For today, I want you to remember the idea that we all have this common heritage. Doesn't matter what forefather we had, whether it was Japheth. In fact, with all the intermixing of the nations, I'm not sure all of us really have a very clear idea about just who our forebears were in that respect. But it doesn't matter who our forebears were. God has dealt with all men equally and the same, and really intended to do that from the very beginning. He didn't single out any group of people for discrimination in the past, and he doesn't single out any group of people for discrimination in the present, except that he discriminates in favor of those people who listen to him, whatever background they may have, whatever heritage they may have come from. He does indeed discriminate in favor of, he promises to respond to the prayers of those who listen to him and those who respond to him. And whatever ethnic heritage we may have, whatever cultural background we may have come from, whatever racial origin we may think that we have in terms of the history of the world, we need to remember that God had in mind that all nations of the earth would have opportunity through his chosen nation and the Savior that he brought out of that nation through the seed of Abraham, that all nations, every family on earth, all nations on earth would be blessed through him. And he was working on that in the things that happened here in this ancient past, in the division of the nations at the very beginning. Paul says he was. Paul doesn't give us an explanation of exactly what God was doing, but he says God set it up this way for a reason, that men might reach out to him and find him, because he's not far from any one of us. I appreciate the fact that that John made the legitimate point yesterday that there were prophets in other nations besides Israel. If you look at the Greek philosophers of the golden age of Greece, you'll find some of the most eloquent arguments for a creator that you'll find anywhere, because there were Greeks who understood that the world had to be created by a single divine eternal being who had the best interests of mankind at heart. You'll find some beautiful, eloquent arguments for a divine creator among the philosophers of not only of Greece, but also of India and also of China and other sources. There were people who recognized what Paul was saying in all the nations. There were people who recognized that there is one God who made us all and to whom we all must respond. And Jesus came, of course, to make it possible for everyone to really know that God, no matter where we come from. Do we have any questions this morning? And we're waiting for the microphone this time around. And by the way, let me just say, you can stump me, okay? In the lot of things we're talking about here, you can stump me. It's not hard. Go ahead.
This may seem superfluous to the point, but what connection did you find between the hierarchical relationships with respect to the fact that, like, Job prayed for his children and could have been perceived as a conduit, as a oracle, that kind of thing, in the process of humanity devolving to a point where they deified themselves?
Well, this may not be an answer to your question. He asked about hierarchical relationships and how Job was very much the head of his family in a religious sense, right, as well as in an authoritarian sense as being the patriarch of his family. But it looks to me like the big change in that is in the 11th chapter when Nimrod steps forward to sort of redefine the roles and relationships, and government takes on a new paternal role. You know, government's going to tell you what to do. Government's going to be responsible for your religion and so on and so forth. That may not be exactly what you're asking, Tim, but I see that as the fly in the ointment, as it were, is the rebellion of man that is involved in the setting up of this sort of monolithic government. Let's all stay together. Let's all do our own thing. Let's have an authoritarian figure. And this is kind of the origin of the religious state, the totalitarian religious state, I think, with what happened there at Babel with Nimrod's pursuit of power. And I'm drawing connections between a lot of things that are not specifically connected, but that's assuming Nimrod is connected with Babel, which is a pretty fair assumption, and so forth. Is that at all an answer to your question? Some conservative ones would. A lot of liberal theologians would certainly not concur with that position. But some conservative interpreters who are biblical literalists would certainly see the significance of Nimrod there in bringing about a worldview change, a change of worldview, with his consolidation of power that way. Because I didn't make it up. I might have, but I didn't. Any other questions? Over here, I'm not sure there's a lot of fingers pointing. You know, John, a lot of people are pointing at you.
Regarding the longevity of man, the Genesis 6 and 3, you remember that?
Okay, Genesis 6 and 3.
The Lord said, "My spirit shall not always strive with men, for that he also is flesh, yet his day shall be 120 years.
Yeah. It's my opinion that that passage is not related to the lifespan of man, but to how much longer it was going to be at that moment when God is looking at the situation. He's giving man 120 years before the door closes. The door of the ark is going to close. I think that 120 years was the time it was going to take for Noah's family to be ready, for Noah himself to do everything that he needed to do, and then the flood was going to come upon the earth. That's my understanding of the 120 years, that's the time frame before the flood.
Now, he was 500 when this started.
Right.
He was 600 when he entered the ark.
Right. He was 500 when he begat his sons, as it says, and it just groups them together there. We know they weren't triplets, but 500 when he became a father.
So I think it's more... My opinion is the 100 is there. The 120 applies to the longevity of men, how they lived after the flood.
Yeah.
And also the...
You're not the only one who believes that. Certainly that has been an understanding of this verse. Well, there are a number of reasons that I don't think that's the case, one of which is that it certainly didn't start very soon. It took a lot of generations before human lifespan got down to that order. We come to Joseph in Egypt, and by that time, by the end of his life, we're beginning to see lifespans in that order. But we don't go down to 120. We go down, as Moses observed in the Psalm, to 80. You know, if a man lives 70 years, that's something. If he lives 80, that's really something. Moses lived 120, but he was quite the exception among his people in doing that.
I was surprised reading the chart showing that Abram was alive when Japheth was alive.
Right.
And he lived only, what, less than 200?
Yeah, Abram lived 175 years. But the lifespan of Shem overlaps out of Abram, if we just, you know, look at the list of the generations there. Which has bearing on the idea of passing on this information from you don't have to pass it from hand to hand to hand to hand, because you've got this overlap of generations there. This isn't what you're talking about, but can you imagine being in the position of Shem and seeing all these generations of your children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren come and go, you know, to outlive them all? Most of us really wouldn't cherish a position like that at all. But I would suggest God had a purpose in mind for Shem, and that he had a role that really no one else could fill, and pass things along that, that God wanted to be passed along. At any rate, that 120 years in Genesis, I understand that people have read that and thought that that was referring to human lifespan, but my understanding of that passage is that God is saying, I'm not just going to let this go on forever. In 120 years, the end is going to come. The flood is going to come on the earth. And he starts talking to Noah, and Noah starts making preparations. And Noah doesn't even have children yet. You know, he doesn't even have a family yet. So how can he be the progenitor of the human race when he has nobody to go in the ark with him? He's got to have sons, and they've got to grow up. And in the meantime, he's got to preach to these people and tell them that judgment is coming if they don't turn from God. In fact, this is a sidelight, but I don't think he was ever inviting anybody, you know, come in the ark with me. He was always inviting people, change your lives, repent, turn to God, because the end is coming. Judgment is imminent, and you need to get ready to face your God. But, yeah, those are the two different approaches to the 120 years, whether the lifespan of humankind, that God is making a pronouncement on that, which, again, I don't see that that's ever been a standard lifespan for humankind. That interval never actually came, as far as I can see, but also the possibility or the interpretation that that's in reference to the coming of that judgment by water, which is my opinion that that's what he was talking about.
One other question. Mm-hmm. When they left the ark, they were meat eaters, and so were the carnivorous animals. I wondered what that kind of how the animals reacted when they had to change their diet.
Well, it would. I have a perspective on just about everything, John. And I think that carnivorous animals are part of the curse that results from the sin. I think that we begin to have carnivorous animals when the ground is cursed for man's sake and begins to bring forth thorns and thistles and so forth. That death is a reality as it had not been before. And I think that we begin to see that. We also begin to see meat eaters, not because God said so, but because, you see, Abel, what was Abel? He was a keeper of flocks. He was a keeper of flocks. What were the descendants of Cain? They were the fathers of all those who keep livestock. Now, what's the difference between a flock and livestock? What's livestock for? Livestock. What's that for? It is for to eat, okay? So the descendants of Cain started eating animals. Did they have permission to do that? See, Abel was using animals. He had flocks. You can use flocks in a lot of ways. A lot of people raise sheep and don't eat them. They shear them. They use the byproducts of the animals, the things that the animals produce. But that's flocks, which Abel had. But with Cain's descendants, it's livestock, and livestock is animals for food. We have Cain's descendants inventing eating animals. And when Noah comes out of the ark, God says, now I'm giving you animals for food. So this was a new thing. I don't think Noah had probably been an animal eater before that, because that wasn't of his heritage. He wasn't of the heritage of Cain. But God says when they came out of the ark, before I gave you all the fruit-bearing trees and so forth for food, and now I'm giving you the animals, but don't eat the blood. You know, he gives this instruction to Noah and to his sons. And that's part of the fact that this is a new world and that they have new needs. And it may have to do with the idea that, you know, with the runoff of sediments and the poor quality. What kind of soil grows good food? Well, topsoil grows good food. Where's all the topsoil when they come out of the ark? Well, you've got all this jumbling and movement of everything with the movements of the flood, and it's going to be a tough go for quite a while. And God says, as they come out of the ark, that they're going to eat meat, which he had not previously sanctioned, but with the caveat that they should not eat the blood. Any other questions? Okay, back there. And that's about what we have time for, is one more. Christian back there.
Okay. So I thought that previous to the flood that they only ate vegetables.
They were only supposed to.
Okay. And couldn't the livestock have been for milk and wool, not meat?
No, there's a difference in language between what it says about Abel keeping flocks and what it says about the descendants of Cain. In the fourth chapter, in verse 20, in Genesis 4:20, Abel bore Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. And my understanding of the word livestock, and, you know, as someone said yesterday, I'm no Hebrew scholar, but I know how to use a dictionary. And this word refers to raising animals for food, that these would be consumables. And that's how we use the word livestock. That's how we use the English word livestock, is animals for consumption. But this is Cain's contribution. This is the lineage of Cain. And the lineage of Cain invents all kinds of marvelous things, like polygamy and the idea of taking personal vengeance and city building and a number of things. Some things that we think are good, but we need to recognize as being worldly, and some things that we would inherently think are bad. They invented the keeping of livestock before God sanctioned anything like that. Okay, and we have a minute, but it's really time for us to take a break before the next class. So we'll pick up with the descendants of Japheth again in the morning.